welcome to Common Geeking Program, a book club podcast where each week three of us read up on a topic and then discuss it from bloodthirsty Nazi-killing perspectives. This week, I am your host, Jonathy Iyer, and we will be discussing the 2009 Quentin Tarantino film, Inglourious Basterds, and Revenge Stories.
Jeez, that was 2009? Oh my god, I feel so right? old. 2009? No.
Did you know that there was a 1978 Inglourious Basterds?
Yes, I did.
Because I pulled it up, right, and it was just like an hour and a half, and I was like, that does not sound right for a Quentin Tarantino movie. So I started playing it, and I was just like, I know his movies usually start to seem a little bit old-timey, but this is quite old-timey.
Anyway.
The attention to detail here is insane.
Guys, my friends, let me finish the introduction, please.
That's gotcha. Ridiculous. That's not how we do things.
I'm joined by two people who will not be quiet, each of whom owes me 100 Nazi scalp. No, I'm just kidding. They're here repping vengeance-fueled domains. All right. Introduce yourselves properly in alphabetical order by first name. That means Jeff goes first.
Yes, that is. I had to think about it for a sec, but no. That does mean I go first.
JK.
Hi,
my name
is Jeff Levitt, and I am going to be repping the anime Code Geass Lelouch of the Rebellion.
All right.
K comes after J.
Yep. No shit.
It's your turn.
No, doesn't Terrence go first? Anyway.
Also, process of elimination.
Yeah. Anyway. Hi, I'm Kenan Kodish. Today I will be talking about the 1973 motion picture High Plains Drifter, starring Clint Eastwood.
All right. Thank you for that. Let's start by summarizing Inglourious Basterds the best I can. And then we will summarize each of these guys' domains before we openly discuss. After that, we will decide whether or not today's topic was enjoyable and close with a competitive rating section to determine who best contributed.
Yee.
So, without further ado...
Or a be-do.
Yeah, it was quiet.
Or J or K-do.
Inglourious Basterds is a 153-minute World War II documentary on... Okay, I'm sorry. I wanted to go on with that, but I can't bring myself to do it. Okay.
You're not wrong. It's just highly inaccurate.
It is. Inglourious Basterds is a Quentin Tarantino film that presents an alternate history of World War II by following sort of two main storylines that end up converging. So, the film opens with a very ominous fur release as, you know, the SS comes to this French farmer's home to, you know, sniff out a Jewish family that's hiding
Jews.
There. And the...
As you do.
The SS officer, Hans Landa, he knows that they're there, but he decides to, like, you know, mess with the dude and stuff. Like make a weird... pipe-based power play and whatnot. You get a real feel for how he likes to do things from that opening.
Yeah, he's a little eccentric, to
so
say the
least.
So the
French family ends up being shot beneath the floorboards where they were hiding, except for Shoshana Dreyfus. She manages to make her way out and run away, and she escapes to Paris, where she changes her name to Emmanuelle Mimieux, and she ends up inheriting a small theater. So this is like 7 years down the line, I think. Is it 7 or 3 years? Oh, I think it's seven.
Seven would be a weird number, I think.
You're a weird number. Anyway.
Truth. I mean, you know, think about where you were in your life 7 years ago, Kenan. That we're 7 years.
Think about how long the war lasted, huh?
Oh, okay. I thought you just meant that would be a weird number to choose. And I was like, well, if that's the number of years later, then it
is. No, like, I mean, the war officially started in 1939.
Friends, I have to summarize this. Come.
Go ahead.
Calm your...
3 years later.
Calm yourselves. Yeah, okay.
Seven sounds more accurate.
I'm literally looking at
it. Oh, wait.
A non-trivial number of years later. she ends up having inherited a theater. but Paris has been overtaken by the Germans, and she is being forced to, you know, only put on German films. And then while she is doing this, a German soldier by the name of Frederick Zoller tries to, you know, like, converse with her, is romantically interested in her, but because, you know, she fucking hates Nazis.
Witnessed the brutal death of her family at the hand of Nazis.
Weird, right?
Yes, she is very not interested in his advances and repeatedly, like, refuses him, rejects him, but, you know, because he's an old-timey and problematic man, he does not take no for an answer.
Way to hold a grudge.
So, Frederick Zoller is actually the subject of a German propaganda film because he managed to survive as a sniper in this tower on his own and defend this tower and kill a bunch of enemy soldiers. And, like, the propaganda officer Goebbels is super into that.
He's a war quote-unquote hero.
Yeah, he's a war hero on the Nazi side, which, you know, doesn't mean much to us. A propaganda film is being made of him, and he's, like, the golden boy. So he manages to convince Goebbels to hold the premiere of this, you know, propaganda film at Shoshana's theater, or Emmanuel Mimieux's theater. So there's a very tense scene in which, you know, she is summoned to this, like, French restaurant with, you know, Hans Landa, who, you know, she hasn't seen for all this time. And, you know, she's very afraid that he recognizes her and is going to just, like, you know, murder her and whatnot.
And he, like, orders her a glass of milk, right?
Right.
Which makes you think, like, maybe he does recognize her since she was on a dairy farm. And there was, like, a whole scene in the beginning with milk.
Or maybe he just loved milk. It's good for you.
Could have.
Maybe. Don't forget the creme. Anyway.
Cream.
So she manages to survive this meeting. She, like, accedes to their, basically, a demand. They think that she should consider it a great honor that her theater is hosting this premiere.
Right. They're not really giving her, like, a choice.
Yeah. So, but then she gets back. She hatches this plot that, you know, she's going to, like, lock the theater doors and, like, explode the whole audience using nitrate film, as one does.
Story of my life.
She's going to, like, videotape herself making this, like, oh man, screw you guys, screw you Nazis, you're gonna die kind of message before this will happen. So, you know, she has a plan.
Classic.
To basically burn down, blow up her own theater. But unbeknownst to her, the second storyline is following the titular Inglorious Bastards. They're a small force of Jewish American soldiers who have gone ahead of the Armada to terrorize the Nazis. But the Allied forces led by the, I think, like, a British operation called Operation Kino.
Which is German for theater.
Oh. Anyway, so they make contact with the bastards. They heard of this propaganda film, and they're like, let's blow up the theater, not knowing that, you know, that was already going to happen.
That Shoshana was going to do it anyway.
That Shoshana was going to do it anyway. And this blowing up the theater plan was conceived by the double agent Bridget von Hammersmark, who is German actress, movie star, and also, you know, double agent to the British. So the bastards and the British officer, who's, like, you know, gonna help out because, you know, he's good at German and most of the American Jewish soldiers are not.
right,
most
yeah,
of
dude.
Them.
Well, the only ones that are good at German are the ones that were actually, like, from Germany,
yeah, the two
right?
Germans.
Like the officer who,
yeah, there's yeah. a Hugo Stiglitz, and then I don't quite remember the other one.
Yeah, I don't think we really talked about him a whole lot.
Hugo Stiglitz was the adopted Inglorious Bastard.
Yeah, he was the ninth member.
Yeah,
right?
He had killed a bunch of Gestapo officers. And then the German high command was wanting to make an example of him, but then the bastards were just like, oh, we too like to kill Nazis. Come, join our stabby party. And then he was like, oh, shit, yeah. So that's what happened with him. But again, I digress. So unfortunately, at the rendezvous point, after another long, tense scene, they are recognized for not being actual Germans. And everyone is shot, except for Bridget von Hammersmark, who escapes, but she leaves a shoe behind, a very telltale shoe, which is very unfortunate.
Also, a fucking autograph with her name on it.
Yeah, like, that's true. Gee, I wonder who was here. I don't know. But anyway, so yeah, so unfortunately, now because Hans Landa comes to investigate this, he is now onto them. He, you know, probably suspects Operation Kino and Bridget von Hammersmark, but the bastards are going to try and, like, get this blowing up the theater thing to work out anyway.
Yeah, well, the big thing, right, is that the reason they decide to go through with it is because they find out that Hitler himself will actually be in attendance.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas before, they thought they were just going to be killing a bunch of, you know, like, high-ranking Nazis. But then they're like, oh, shit, we could kill the high-ranking Nazi.
The Nazi.
Exactly.
And they're like, both of our German people got shot, and the British guy got shot, and none of us know any German at all. We only know, like, a little bit of Italian, but we're still going to try anyway, because how could you not? It's Hitler.
Sure, may as well.
Right. Unfortunately, they're, their prowess at Italian leaves something to be desired. And when they show up at the premiere...
Oh my god. That's like my favorite part of the movie is fucking Brad Pitt as Aldo doing his fucking Italian...
Arrivederci.
Speaking. It's so good.
Oh man. So anyway, of course Hans Landa is...
Buongiorno.
It speaks very good Italian and decides to... mess with them by testing their Italian skills. He kills Bridget von Hammersmark, ends up capturing Aldo and Yudovich,
who's played by BJ Novak.
And, you know, it really seems like he's gonna have his way, and it turns out his way is to be like, nah, blow up the theater, go ahead, but I want all this credit for it, I want this, like, sweet nest egg, I want a deal.
I want a medal.
Yeah, he's a fucking narc.
Yeah, he wants the Congressional Medal of
for
Honor.
Everybody.
He wants property in Nantucket. It's really quite funny. So he manages to negotiate this deal with the commanding officer, a general. And meanwhile, like, theater gets blown up. Funnily enough, the bastards succeed in blowing up Hitler separately, like, in the bathroom. But
no, it's in his booth in the like opera booth.
In his booth. Oh yeah.
Yeah, they barge in and they just shoot him a whole bunch, and I'm sure someone enjoyed making like
right.
a prosthetic of Hitler's face and just shot it like beyond recognition.
Yeah.
Because I remember like the first time watching this movie, I was just like, oh yeah, this is set in World War II, and I guess these are supposed to be people that we didn't care enough about. So it's like, oh, you know, that like it mends history a little bit in terms of like who's actually around and doing what, right?
Mm-hmm.
But like clearly Hitler's gonna make it out, and then I'm just like, oh no, they're just killing Hitler right there.
Yeah, they killed Goebbels too, as well as what was that fat guy's name? The head of the Wehrmacht and the Luftwaffe. No, he was head of the Luftwaffe, some sky marshal, whatever.
Anyway, but then unfortunately, like Private Zoller has like left his seat and has gone to once again harass Shoshana when she's on the cusp of her like big revenge plot, and she's just like, oh, not this fucker again. She ends up feeling kind of bad for him at the last minute and also kind of gets shot, but I mean they were both destined to burn down in the theater anyway.
Yeah, they just like shoot each other.
The theater burns up, everyone's like locked inside, no one can escape.
Also the fucking like Shoshana's tape that she left is fucking great, because she's just like saying like, oh yeah, you're getting killed by a Jew, and it's like cackling as like the flames surround the theater. It's all very
it's extremely theatrical. I mean, yeah, it is.
but it's also just like, yeah, you think I'm the devil? Fuck yeah, bitch, I am.
She owns it.
Very unapologetic, very victorious.
Very inglorious.
So, meanwhile, at the end of the movie, Aldo and Yudovich are driven to American lines as prisoners. Then when they are on, like, the Allied side, according to the terms of surrender, Hans Landa is now, like, technically their prisoner. They immediately shoot his, like, assistant,
his radio man,
which they weren't supposed to do, but, you know, they'll just get chewed out for it. It's okay.
Yeah, they're like, you'll be shot for this. No, I'll be chewed out. I've been chewed out before.
Yeah, I don't think anyone would be like, why'd you kill those Germans at the end, huh?
Yeah, so anyway, and then in keeping of the movie, though they cannot kill Hans Landa, they do end up carving the swastika into his forehead, as they do to survivors, because they don't like that.
I pretend not to be Nazis.
At some point, Nazis will take off their uniforms, and they, you know, like to know who the Nazis are when they see
them.
Yeah,
like to know who is a Nazi. Yeah.
Gotta know.
And then, yeah, that's the end of the movie.
Yeah.
And then you get this, like, delightful little swingy march thing that goes do-do-do-do, do-do-do-do. And then you get credits.
It's very satisfying on like a carnal level.
it truly is. It's very bloody. It makes you enjoy violence in a way.
Classic Tarantino, very stylized.
Yeah.
Indeed. Quite. So that is our summary on Inglourious Basterds with a few key digressions, but I think we got all the good points. Stuff in there.
You need a couple good key digressions every once in a while.
All right. So, yeah, would you guys like to summarize your domains?
Sure, Jeff will go first.
Fuck yeah,
I will. It was my plan right there, because I told you to go first.
I will go first, because that was the alphabetical order that we took way too many seconds to figure out.
Listen, you don't need to, like, take it, okay?
Hi.
All right?
My name is Jeff.
Nerd.
This week, I'm going to be talking about an anime series called Code Geass, Lelouch of the Rebellion. Or Code Geass for short.
Or Code for even shorter.
It is also a little bit of a revenge story. Keenan, I can barely hear you, so I'm just going to talk through whatever side comments you're trying to make. So it's set in an alternate history where basically there are a few superpowers, the biggest one being the Britannian Empire. And like kind of the thing about the show is that the Britannian Empire just took over Japan recently and made it now Area 11. So the entire show more or less takes place in Japan, and it's like the sort of like political resistance of the Japanese culture being taken over by this big huge superpower, right?
Mm-hmm.
And meanwhile, our main character, Lelouch Lamprouge, or as we find out, Lelouch v. Britannia, is the estranged son of the Britannian Emperor.
Mm-hmm.
And a few years before the occupation of Japan, he was stationed to live there. So he like made friends with people in Japan, like Suzaku Kurugi,
mm-hmm.
who's like his best friend. And then fast forward a little bit, Japan is now occupied. Lelouch, so his mother was killed, and the attack also crippled his younger sister, Nonnally. And Lelouch thinks that it was, like, definitely the fault of his father, or at the very least, his father didn't do enough about it afterwards, right? So he's got, like, this revenge scheme against his father and the whole Britannian Empire.
Mm-hmm.
But now he is in hiding as just a Britannian kid living in Japan, mm-hmm. or Area 11, as they call it. So he goes to, like, a prep school, and there's, like, the whole dichotomy between, like, oh, you know, there are the Britannian people living in Japan, and then there are the Japanese people living in Japan, and
11s.
They're kind of, like, looked down upon, and, like, all the Japanese people live in, like, ghettos. Yeah, they call them 11s. So Lelouch is, like, a really smart motherfucker. He can beat everybody at chess, so he's, like, a strategic thinker. And it's implied that, like, oh, you know, he wants to do things about it, but he, like, lacks the means, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then early on, he ends up getting involved with this, like, this geo-weapon that's being transported and, like, stolen by the Japanese rebellion.
As one does.
Classic.
Yeah, from the Britannian Empire, right? And then he ends up getting wound in that because, like, the car crashes and he ends up, like, going in to help, and then, like, he ends up getting taken by them,
yes.
without their knowledge. And then it turns out the geo-weapon is this woman who's named C2, and this is the whole other thing about the show where the fucking Geass comes in, is that, like, there's this, like, weird, like, mystical sort of, like, pseudo-religious thing that's been going on for centuries and centuries, where there's, like, a lineage of these people who pass down these, like, abilities and then, like, end up becoming immortals afterwards.
Fun fact, the word Geass comes from, like, I believe Irish. There's a similar word in Scottish Gaelic, but it actually, like, means an obligation or a vow.
Oh, okay.
So it's just, like, an old-timey, like, oh, yeah, you must do this. I, like, lay this Geass upon you.
Whoa,
like,
no way.
This, like,
that
very
makes sense.
Serious obligation.
That's so fitting.
Yeah, so I
did not know
probably
that.
Probably not a coincidence.
But anyway.
Weird.
So, yeah, so Lelouch is at the last second before he's about to be executed by some, you know,
some
Britannian
poser.
Guards who are, like, cleaning the area of life, basically, because of this weapon, which is this woman, right? He's given the Geass where he can just tell people what to do and they have to do it. So he tells all the guards to kill themselves and they do it. And then from there, he ends up, like, you know, A leads to B, and he ends up putting on this second identity of Zero, where he wears a mask and he starts leading the Japanese rebellion, and they don't know his identity, and, you know, he lives this second life of a school life,
mm-hmm.
right? But it's like, oh, all to get revenge on his father, ultimately. So, yeah. That's the gist of the show. I could probably go into a bit more detail on, like, some of the things that happen later, but that's about my time.
How long is the show?
It's two seasons, three seasons, I think.
Yeah.
Okay.
Two? I think it's at least
and
two.
I think they're each about 24 episodes of like 22 minute length, so pretty standard stuff.
Okay. All right. Good to know.
Yeah. It's a fun time.
What about you, Keenan?
That's me.
What you got?
That is your real name.
I have for you a classic, if you don't know. High Plains Drifter, like I said, 1973, starring Clint Eastwood, is a Western, because it's Clint Eastwood in the 70s, so how could it not be? and of course, most Westerns are pretty much synonymous with vengeance. So in this one, it has a very classic setup. Drifter with no name, wanders into small town. Small town needs a gunfighter because these guys are coming after him.
As so happens in the West.
Yes, as happens in the West, and then he helps him. But like the thing is, he helps him out weird-like. He like lets him make him sheriff and stuff. But he like it's very clear from the onset that he has his own ulterior motives for helping them.
Are you sure he's not just high?
Yes.
Because he's the High Plains Drifter. Okay, I'm done.
Ho! 420 blazer. anyway, what it turns out, because the town hires him to, like, fight these three brothers who are coming out of jail, the Duncan brothers, right?
The Duncan brothers!
Yeah, because, like, it turns out, like, this town kind of fucked these guys over by, like, turning them in, because they had a deal with these brothers to, like, kill their sheriff, so that way they could sell their land to, so they could keep a mine, because the thing is, the town people found a mine, but it was on government land. So, the sheriff was like, well, I have to announce that this mine is here, but they were like, oh, but sheriff, you take this mine away, like, our monies will go away. And he's like, yeah, but it's the right thing. So they hired the brothers to kill the sheriff, then turn the brothers in, basically.
Oh, it was just like a conspiracy crime, like the whole town was in on it.
Oh no, his name was, the sheriff's name was Duncan, it was the Bridges brothers. Stacy, which by the way, given the song Stacy's Mom, has a whole different, like, meaning when watching this. It's like, Stacy's coming, I was like, oh no, what about her mom though? Like, is she coming too? Because if she's not, I'm not really that interested. Anyway, so eventually he's like, he makes him just do a whole bunch of weird stuff. He's like, yeah, just paint the whole town red. And he's like, okay. And he's like, yeah, take the...
Is that where that expression comes from?
Probably not, because given what's going to happen.
Maybe it was just a visual gag on part of the filmmakers. It was like, let's make them literally paint the town red.
Yeah, and then he makes, you know, them replace the sign, which is like Lago to Hell. And then he makes them like prepare a feast.
That's very different.
Yeah, like an actual picnic tables, like with food, and it has a welcome banner when they come.
This is beginning to sound quite ominous. My goodness.
Yeah, right? And then slowly, they come in and they start like shooting the people who like double cross them, and like they're trying to defend themselves. And like eventually, like the Bridges brothers, they take over like the town, and at night, then all of a sudden, like one by one, they all start being like taken out with a whip. And it's because the sheriff was killed with a whip. Like, they whipped him to death in the streets. And then eventually, the town's been, like, basically destroyed. The only guy who actually, like, is a good guy in this is a little man named Mordecai. And, like, basically, Mordecai's digging a grave. He's been made mayor. He's digging a grave for the sheriff, because they never buried the sheriff. And then the stranger's like, well, my job's done. He's about to ride out. And Mordecai's like, wait, I never got your name. And then the stranger goes, you do know my name. And he rides off and he literally disappears. And then, like, it pans over to, like, the sheriff's head. He was burying the sheriff. Like, that's what he was doing. He's making a new headstone for the sheriff. It's heavily implied that the whole time he was the sheriff all along. Like, the ghost of a sheriff.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, right? It's crazy. It's like he just makes the townspeople do all this weird stuff the entire movie. And then, like, basically lets them get their ass kicked. Lets their town be destroyed. Then kills the guy who, you know, killed him, and then just disappears. He's like, see ya, kid. You're the only one who was actually nice to me.
God damn.
No, yeah, no, it's like three revenge in one. It's crazy.
Yeah, and I'm glad that you picked a Western to do, because, I mean, Tarantino is heavily influenced by the whole Western thing, down to the Ennio Morricone soundtrack, so, like,
yeah, ace. Well, yeah, I thought, like, a Western would be perfect, because, you know, as I said earlier, Westerns are just kind of synonymous with vengeance. A lot of Westerns are about that, you know.
All good points.
Yeah, like I said, that's High Plains Drifter. I really enjoyed it. It was, I think, one of the highest grossing Westerns of the decade.
Okay.
So that was pretty impressive, you know?
Yeah, given all the Westerns that were just flying out of Italy. So now let's move on to the discussion portion.
The discussion portion.
Yes.
It's the discussion.
Yes.
Yes. Discussion.
This is all the discussion is, actually. I like promised we would talk about revenge, but really we'll just go, yes, revenge, yes. Anyway.
That's kind of what the movie was like, honestly.
I hope this whole episode isn't actually just a revenge, like, you gathered us here to get revenge on us. That'd be rough.
Oh, no. Like, if this was a revenge plot, like, if I actually have, like, people outside your homes right now to, like, revenge myself upon you.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow, that's specific, Jonavi. Is there something you want to... Have we done something to offend you?
No, actually, no. You guys are both pretty harmless, as far as I can tell. But...
Oh, if only you knew.
Wait a minute.
If only.
I mean, totally, right. Practically, we're sheep. Bah.
Anyway, as I was saying, the first question I have for you two has a bit of an introduction. Oh. So revenge kind of straddles the line between righteous justice type stuff and like, oh man, this is sinful wrath. He has gone too far kind of stuff. So... what are the elements of, like, writing and design and all of those, like, storytelling elements that affect how we view characters that fall on this vengeance spectrum? And what is, I guess, like, the most sympathetic revenge character in Inglourious Basterds?
I'll take this one.
Hmm.
I think one of the big aspects of a revenge plot is everything you described, actually, I think is always brought up in a lot of revenge plots because there's that questioning that makes it interesting of, like, what is this? Is this actually vengeance? Is this justice? Wrath? You know, that kind of thing.
Like, are you as bad as them?
Exactly. But I think one of the things that really makes, like, a vengeance character very sympathetic is when it portrays a failure of the conventional law or another overarching power to right a wrong.
Yeah.
Like in High Plains Drifter or in Code Geass, are the parties were wronged by an overarching power that could not be used against itself. So it had to come from an outside source. Lelouch had to become zero to get revenge. High Plains Drifter had to come back from the dead and then just murder and screw over the town.
Whereas, like, in, like, Inglourious Basterds, it's, like, all within the convention of war, pretty much, you know? Like...
it is true. Like, there are moments where you're just being like, hey, these are Nazi soldiers, but, you know, they're also humans, because Nazis are humans. You might find them reprehensible humans that, you know, still need to be destroyed, as it were. But you... you have to acknowledge, like, you know, that's...
like, this guy's a father.
Yeah, like, this guy's a father, or, like, this guy wanted to protect his fellow soldiers, despite being on, you know, history's wrong side, so...
Right, and he, like, clearly is, like, not as about all of the killing as, like, the rest of the Nazis are, Zoller.
Sure, so...
he just did it.
Yeah.
I mean, he's got other reasons that make him kind of a shit guy, like his, like, creepiness with Shosana, but...
yeah, he totally is. I think one of the things about Inglourious Basterds that is really one of the reasons why we should always talk about Inglourious Basterds is that it kind of examines using Quentin Tarantino's stylized violence to examine exactly, like, how... like, because the Inglourious Basterds, they're not good people. They're, like, it's really, like you said, like... they are the kind of, like, the wrath.
Yeah. They are very, you know, like, bloodthirsty.
Yeah.
Exactly. And, like, even, like, the really the reprehensible characters, like we said, most of them have, like, kind of understandable. Even, like, the French farmer who sold out Dreyfus. Like, it's because, you know, he, like, threatened his family. And, like, it's even understandable.
Like, I think most viewers feel very bad for him in that scene.
Yeah.
Poor Monsieur Lapadite.
But, yeah, I mean, like... when talking about, like, which character is, like, the most sympathetic, I think I would lean towards saying Shosana, but I think that's, like, part of that is because we actually see what happens to her, whereas, like, the other bastards were just, like, you know, we can pick up pieces, but ultimately, like, we don't see their stories, whereas, like, at the very beginning of the movie, right, like, we feel Shosana's, like, terror when, mm-hmm. you know, her family is, like, shot up.
Yeah, she's the story's representative, I guess, of the Jewish experience.
Right, and she's, like, not any less, when it comes to it, she's not any less ruthless than any of the bastards are, right? Like, at the very end, you know, she shoots the guy, and then there's, like, this reel of her, like, laughing satanically with, like, the flames in the background while she, like, murders a whole group of people. It's, like, the same kind of stuff that the bastards are doing.
But it is less visceral than, like, physically beating someone to death.
That's true.
There's definitely a sliding scale of brutality. Like, if someone poisons someone and then, like, kills themselves, that is a different kind of murder than someone who's just like, first I'm going to humiliate you, and then I'm going to, like, beat you to death, and then I'm going to dismember your body. Like, those are different things.
Yeah, it's true. But I think, like, Shosana, right, like, she did want to, like, humiliate them. Like, she didn't just set the place on fire so they'd all be dead. She made mm-hmm. a point of, like, putting in this reel that's like, hey, motherfuckers, this is the person that is killing you, you know?
She wanted them to know.
Yeah, exactly, right? Like, it definitely was, like, a vengeance-filled thing, right? But I think, big difference between her and the bastards, right, is that we see her story. Mm-hmm. So she seems, like, more sympathetic. Not that, like, in the movie, like, I don't think I ever really think the Inglourious Basterds are going too far, you know? I'm, like, rooting for them the whole time.
Right.
But it's like, you get those fuckers instead of, like, I feel bad for you because of what's happened to you, like it is with Shosana.
And that plays into a lot of Tarantino movies, I think. You are made to kind of, revel in violence a little bit, regardless of how you feel about it.
Yeah, there's a lot of fuck yeah deaths.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, comparing it to Code Geass, right?
Mm-hmm.
Definitely, I think you're led to kind of not really think that Lelouch is as sympathetic of a character throughout the course of it. And it's mm-hmm. also, like, brought into question about, like, whether the revenge is worth it, or, like, whether he's doing it to protect the Japanese people or just to get revenge on his father. Whereas, like, that question is not really ever brought up in Inglourious Basterds, you know? Like, there's never anyone being like, should we really be doing all these vengeanceful things? In that way, it makes those characters seem more sympathetic, because the narrative of the story is never telling us to question this vengeful behavior. Whereas, like, a story like Code Geass, I think that part of the message is like, hey, maybe you have to let go of these vengeful things to actually do the right thing at some point, you know?
Mm-hmm. Why?
I guess that leads me to, I guess, the second question.
Can you guys hear me at all?
Which, up for grabs, I'd like you both to kind of talk about these questions, but whatchamacallit? Here they are.
Hey, guys.
Sorry, got distracted by myself for a second. Has that ever happened to you?
Yeah, anyway. You're just like, oh shit, you're here. Wait a minute, you're always here. Silly voices in my head.
Hello?
Wow, I will neither confirm nor deny the existence of voices. In any case, how do you think...
You guys just not fucking, like, noticing me? Like, you guys realize, like, I haven't been...
How, if ever, do you think that revenge stories try and address some kind of moral question, or, like, a question of, like,
guys,
I think justice was served versus I think this man was ruined?
Right.
Guys.
Sorry, what did you say, Keenan?
Oh, you didn't hear me?
We're having some hard times hearing you again.
All right, because, like...
I can hear you now.
All right, you can't?
Now I can hear you, yes.
Yeah.
Guys?
Yes, hello? Can you hear us?
God. I can hear you right now. Can you hear me?
Okay. We can hear you.
Maybe. I think it's just...
I don't know if you guys noticed, but I just wasn't in the call for the past, like...
Yeah. You cut out, but I thought that you were listening. Yeah. I didn't know.
No, I wasn't here. Like, I kept getting kicked out, like, three different times.
Oh.
Oh, gosh. Okay. Oh, all right.
I thought you guys would have noticed.
I mean,
well, I was talking. We just thought you were listening to us.
But I wasn't on the screen though.
I mean,
yeah, but I'm not. You're never on the screen because you don't have. I'm looking at the chronograph. I just see Johnny's face in the corner.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. That explains why. Because like I wasn't looking at anything.
Oh, okay.
All right. What was the question?
Well, first of all, do you feel that you were able to finish answering the first question?
Yes. I actually said something. I caught a little bit of what Jeff was saying at one point about, like, you're not supposed to be sympathetic for Lelouch, it feels, at the beginning. And I would agree with him because I think one of the things that revenge motifs hinge upon is a certain level of intimacy. But that also drives the plot, not knowing why. Like, if you look at Inglourious Basterds, you know right away why.
Yeah.
And you're hooked. Like, you want to get the revengeance, right? You know why, like, they need
exactly. Yeah. It's part of the conceit of a World War II Nazi film that an American person makes.
Exactly. But if you look at, like, Code Geass or High Plains Drifter, a little bit of it is like, what is he, like, planning for this town? Or Lelouch? Like, why do you care?
You kind of, like, figure out as you go.
Yeah, it's interesting because it also gets you because, like, you want to know why they have this anger or this resentment or this, like, attitude about doing this. And, like, that really draws you. Like, you know vaguely, like, Lelouch doesn't like...
Keenan?
High Plains Drifter. You're getting paid here. What the hell?
Keenan?
Yes? Oh, I finished. Is that okay?
That's what she said.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, we had cutting out a little bit at the end.
Yeah, you were cutting out a bit. I had trouble hearing you, but sounds like you were saying some good stuff.
Long story short, intimacy is key in revenge, whether you establish it right away or you're waiting to reveal it. That way it draws you in to propel the story to make it more interesting because you want to know why Lelouch hates
so, them. So, yeah. I guess going off of that, would you consider somebody who seeks to kill or seeks to cause harm without that kind of like personal intimacy more like monstrous or worse than someone who's driven to that by some kind of personal grievance? Because that's kind of a central question of revenge, right? Like,
right.
Who can you identify with more and who's more human is often seen as like, oh, okay, this person, like, we can understand it more, so we're being more receptive to it. Yeah. As opposed to someone who's just, like, you know, more detached, but is still choosing to do these harmful things.
Yeah. There's this, like, type of character that I identify in these movies,
mm-hmm.
which I call the good person who does bad things. I know that sounds, like, ridiculous, but when you look at, like, these revenge movies, like, do you think Dreyfus was a bad person? No, I don't think she was a bad person. She was mm-hmm. just someone trying to survive. But then she did this whole... objectively, it's a bit of a horrific act, burning, you know, 100 people with their wives and girlfriends, you know, alive in a theater is objectively a horrible act. However, I would say subjectively, she's a good person that did a bad thing. That's where it becomes okay. However, let's take Hitler doing these things. Hitler is a bad person who did bad things, right?
He also likes the number 9
and,
a lot.
Yeah, and the question is, like, when does it end? Kind of a thing. I think that's important in revenge kind of movies, especially like about like where do you become the monster?
Mm-hmm.
Like if Dreyfus had survived that theater burning,
mm-hmm.
I don't think she would have ever killed again.
Yeah, probably not.
And I think that speaks to them as a person. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but I mean, like, I think it also like with Inglourious Basterds, we're definitely put in this like historical context.
Or like, look at the High Plains Shifter. He just walked away, disappeared.
Right, but, like, I think it also, like, the thing with Inglourious Basterds, right, is that, like, pretty much all of the characters act the same. You know, we are given glimpses of a sympathetic nature from the SS people, and, you know, we're given, like, lots of horrific things that the Basterds and Shoshana do, right? But we're, like, I don't think we're ever really pushed to the point of thinking, like, oh, these two sides are the same. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and I don't think that that would have been Tarantino's intent.
Right.
I would argue that with the Basterds, but that's just me.
I think Inglourious Basterds is trying to get at something of like, hey, even if you're on the right side, that doesn't, you know, make you an angel.
Yeah.
And being on the wrong side still makes you horribly wrong, but you're not inhuman.
Yeah, it's unproductive to think of the bad guys as just like, you know, these monsters who, you know, do nothing good in their lives, right?
Mm-hmm.
But also, like, I feel like revenge stories kind of fall into two camps. And one camp is, like, represented by, like, you know, the Inglourious Basterds, where it's, like, sort of a cathartic sort of, like, hey, we're all still pretty upset about the Holocaust, right? Do you want to just, like, watch the scene of this guy taking a machine gun to Hitler's face and be like, fuck yeah!
Yes!
You know? Like, that's, like, a cathartic sort of thing. And then the other, like, side of revenge stories is to sort of critique the whole concept of, like, revenge and be like, hey, is this really going to be the best thing for you in the long run?
Sure.
Which is sort of, like, where I feel Code Geass falls in, right, is there's a lot of, like, dissecting why Lelouch is doing what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's like, oh, yeah, like, clearly he's doing the right thing because he's helping the Japanese people gain their independence back. But then it's also, like, we have to think about, like, is he really doing it for that reason, or is he doing it just because he wants to get a revenge on his dad? And if those two things end up intersecting, right, will that always be the best thing for the Japanese people?
Gotcha.
And, like, sometimes not, right? Whereas in Inglourious Basterds, yeah, Shosana, I don't think her primary reason is, like, oh, to keep the rest of everyone safe and end the war. I think her primary reason is to kill all the people who have done terrible things to her, right? But you don't have to really, like, straddle with that argument because they align. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's true. Like, it's...
The best thing for her revenge story is the best thing for the world.
True. But I would say that I think one of the things that should be considered... is part of, like, the way that the Basterds are depicted. If you look at them, they're not really the human ones. The ones who are the most humanized are actually the average Germans. Because if you look at the first scene where, like, you really see the Basterds post-battle, they beat, you know, a guy who, this brave war hero, who probably fought in, like, World War One, given his age, to death. Like, just for simply being a soldier on the opposite side. Not even for, like, being a Jew hunter or anything. Like I said, I think it's a little examination of the romanticization we have with this violent catharsis, you know, if you think about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say that's definitely true. The whole concept of justice is kind of tied up in that, of just like, oh, if you do something bad, you must be punished.
Yeah, they even give Honda a pass. Like, that, those are the good guys. The good guys give the Jew hunter a pass, you know.
But they only, like, sort of give him a pass, because they do carve a swastika into his forehead.
Right. In, like, towards the means of ending the entire war. But that brings me to my last question of Hans Landa.
Hans Landa.
He is not motivated by revenge throughout the story.
No, he's just, like, self-interest, right?
Notably so. He's motivated for personal gain and does not really seem to care about, like, for anyone who gets in his way. So this is part of what makes him such an easy character to love-hate. Like, he's very smug and entertaining, but also you, like, want to punch him all the time because he's so, like, self-serving.
When they're, like, giving him the swastika at the end, like, that is a really satisfying scene. Sure. It's just like, hey, you didn't fucking think this out through all the way, did you, motherfucker?
Together frozen.
You had mentioned before that Shosana's, like, revenge stuff was also, like, self-serving in the end. Like, she wanted the satisfaction of having done this.
Right.
But her character is more palatable than someone who's just like, well, yeah, this is selfish, but it's not really bloodthirsty. It's just more dispassionate, and I'm really smug about it.
Yeah.
So, like, what makes, like, let's try and get at, like, how can we parse these two things about one character who's, like, bloodthirsty and vengeful being more sympathetic than someone who's, you know, more dispassionate, just kind of thinks he's better than everyone?
Well, I mean,
and then we'll, like, kill dispassionately.
I'm exiting, and I'm coming back.
Right. Well, I mean, I think a lot of it is just, like, you know, she's doing it for a better reason, you know? Like, horrible things were done to her, so you can understand why she'd be angry. Whereas, like, you know, Hans Landa, like...
Oh, and the double J's, Genevieve.
He just abides by a lot of the things that are going on, you know, in the, like, Nazi regime, even though, right, like...
Jeff Genevieve, who knows?
Right? He's not really doing it because he's, like, afraid of being persecuted or whatever. Like, I think part of that is, like, really what gets it, right, is that, like, Hans Landa would kill under normal circumstances if it benefited him, whereas, like, Shosana is, like, enacting her revenge for horrible things that were done to her. Like, if no horrible things were ever done to her, would she have ever killed someone? Probably not.
I think we're getting then back to this whole thing of, like, you feel like because one is more understandable and human than the other, you're more willing to...
What?
Keenan, you there?
What are we talking about? Yep, I'm here.
We're talking about why we think Shosana is more sympathetic character than Hans Landa is, even though, like, she's more passionately revengeful and he's just kind of, like, casually dispassionate.
Well, it's because that casual, it's that that nonchalant about the horrific acts that he does, because he has no real reason to do this except for personal gain, and so that selfish desire is his only motivation.
Yeah, exactly.
But, like, personal gain for vengeance is then more excusable than just, like, personal gain for whatever?
Well, because if it's for personal gain, that's not really vengeance.
I think Kenan's still trying to talk. I think that we're just not hearing him.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can hear you.
Yeah, I was just saying that personal gain is not vengeance. That's the big thing about it.
I can't hear you now if you're talking.
Oh, god damn it.
I heard a blip.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Kenan's whole side of this recording is going to be so frustrated.
Yeah.
Can you hear me now?
You back?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Oh, jeez, Kenan.
Can you? No.
No, we cannot hear you, sadly.
Oh, my God.
We heard, oh, my God.
I heard that.
You can hear me?
Yes.
I heard, oh, my God. Yeah, we can hear that.
Okay, well, I kind of gave my whole spiel about personal gain, but basically, personal gain is not vengeance. If you look at
that
the revenge stories, they don't profit from it. Lelouch killing, you know, the Britannians doesn't bring back his mother. The sheriff killing, you know, his murderers and destroying the town doesn't bring him back to life.
Right.
You know, and Landon doing his thing doesn't, you know, it's not vengeance. It's not for personal gain. It's to right a wrong and to prevent any wrongs from going further.
You mean like Shosana's thing is?
Yeah, like Shosana doesn't, you know, that is vengeance. She rights her wrong, and then she also makes sure it will never happen to anyone. Those people can never harm anyone ever again.
Yeah, but I think that the question there is of motivation, right? Like, is Shosana doing this to end the war, or is she doing this because of this personal vengeance that she wants to, like, carry out, you know?
And it seems to me that it's about more of the personal vengeance.
Yeah.
Than it is about ending the war, because she doesn't leave any kind of message to the outside world about, like, hey guys, this is what I've done.
Yeah, but it doesn't matter if, like, that's the whole point, Inglourious Bastards. She didn't want any glory from saying, oh, well, I killed Hitler and the entire Third Reich ruling class. No, she just did it because she said, you know, Adolf Hitler will be here, and she knew what that meant.
Yeah, but see, I think that there's a difference between, because, like, I don't know that, like, I would say that vengeance necessarily is quite the same thing as, like, personal gain. Hans Landa is doing things for personal gain, and Shosana is doing things for vengeance, but there is this third alternative of doing things because they are the right thing to do, right? Like, doing things for the purpose of ending the war, whereas I don't feel like Shosana is doing it for personal gain, but I do feel she is doing it for, like, this personal vendetta, you know?
Yeah.
It's sort of like a gray area.
I think it was little column A, little column B, you know?
Yeah, I think that it's easy to identify like that because it lines up with perhaps what is good for the greater world, you know, to, like, have Hitler not be a thing. But...
No, but she said that.
Does she?
Yeah, she said Adolf Hitler will be in this theater. If she really wanted just frank personal vengeance, she would have just tried to kill Landa, who she didn't even know was going to be there.
Yeah, but, like, Hitler is the mask behind Landa.
Yeah, but, like, Hitler didn't pull the trigger. If it was just personal, if it was, like, truly, like, I'm just trying to get the man who murdered my sisters... It would be Landa, and maybe even, like, that farmer. But, like, she went so far beyond that I think that almost disqualifies, like, the just immediate personal vendetta.
I do think it was a vendetta against, like, the Nazi party, you know?
The, like, the personal satisfaction of just, like, I want you to see the face of the Jews who killed you.
Yeah, right. It wasn't so the outside world would view her.
Even if it's not a concrete personal gain, you're still doing it from a personal place of, like, I want you to suffer. I want that.
Well, yeah, all vengeance is intimate.
She cares more about them suffering than them not making other people suffer.
Exactly. And that was kind of the motivation behind my question. Because when you do something for vengeance, it's more like you're getting to take something away from someone else.
Yeah.
But when you're doing something for personal gain, like, there is a concrete gain you get from it. It's more logical in that way of, like, I do this to get that
right.
for me. Like, it's more tangible. The clear villain in Inglourious Basterds is Hans Landa.
Yeah.
He's very clearly set up to be, like, this smug monster. He kills a bunch of people with impunity. He turns his back on the people who he was working with in order to negotiate a better deal for himself.
Right.
And, like, we view, like, all of that as just like, oh, like, someone please carve a swastika in his head. But for Shoshana, because, like, we feel for her and we're, like, rooting for her side, even though she's motivated by, like, I just want all these people to die, but Hans Landa is just like, yeah, die or don't die, whatever, at least give me something out of it.
Yeah.
Like, I'm trying to parse out why we consider one of these way more acceptable than another, even though the other one sounds more logical because you get stuff from it that's
But I mean, I think it's including the context of the horrible things that happened to Shoshana.
Sure.
There's a certain morality to it.
Keeping in line with the atrocities that, like, the Nazi party and, like, the specific things we see happen to her.
Yeah.
Right?
But something being sympathetic doesn't make it right. It just makes us feel better about it.
No, and, like, that's the thing about a lot of revenge stories is that you have to consider the context of the people.
Yeah.
Take, for example, like, Landa's just killing not random people, but he's just killing people for, yeah, personal gain, and sure, that's logical, but those people did no wrong. However,
yeah,
the townspeople, the Nazis, the Britannians did wrong.
Yeah, exactly.
It is a reactionary force. It is a intimate affair, so it is really emotional, and the reason why we identify with it is because I think subconsciously
you cut out at subconsciously.
You cut out after the word subconsciously.
We subconsciously, can you hear me now? What about now?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. We subconsciously.
Yep. Yes.
We subconsciously.
You cut out again right after the word subconsciously.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay. We want rights to be wronged in the world. And
I think we are also getting to the point where, even interruptions aside, we should probably be trying to move on a little bit now because we do have listener questions. But
all right, fuck it.
I agree with what I think you were about to say.
Yeah. I guess in closing, so it sounds like kind of the general consensus here is that there needs to be a little bit of the justice element mixed in.
Has to be.
Yeah, like Keenan was saying, I think a big part of it is the fact that it's reactionary versus someone just doing things for their own personal gain, you know?
Right. So for a satisfying revenge story, you have to have a horrible, unforgivable tragedy.
Right.
Just right off the bat, so that you already have the sad part out of the way, and then you get the, like, satisfying anger itchy part.
Yeah.
And then if you also get to penalize someone who looked like they were gonna get away with something, not let them get away with it all the way.
Yeah.
So that's what I have to mumble at the end of that. But anyway, we have listener questions. So, Rich, is this Baldus? Rich Baldus? That is what is written here.
Sure, Baldus.
Yes, it is Baldus. Rich Baldus. He asks, why does Quentin Tarantino choose to make movies that are so overwrought with tension? Is this an end unto itself? Keenan, you go first.
Well, I would say it's overwrought with tension in all Quentin Tarantino's movies, mainly because that is one of his very stylized forms. I know that sounds like a bit of a cop-out, but, like, that's just something that he does, mainly to propel the story, because that makes every scene, because, like, every scene, like, it's very high, it's almost, like, anxiety-inducing, knowing that something's about to happen. But I think that's a real art form in that he can make any scene be that way. You know, there's literally scenes where people are just kind of talking, and you're like, oh god, something's coming. It's going to happen. I don't know what, but, like, we're in a car someplace. And then later, after you know that's Quentin Tarantino, then you start looking for it everywhere.
Yeah.
So Keenan, you would say that, yeah, that is an end unto itself because it plays into his style?
Yes, I would say so, very much so.
All right. What about you, Jeff Wee?
I mostly agree with what Keenan said. I think that, like, a lot of the reasons that he does that is also kind of like playing off of some of that Western genre tropes and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Like gun draw scenes and shit like that, right?
It's high noon.
Yeah, exactly. Like it always works towards a big payoff, right? Where there's like a lot of shit that happens at the end of this like suspenseful scene.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would say that it is whatever the expression was, an end into itself, because it's like, I think Keenan's right. Like you are sort of meant to feel that way because you have that impression of it because it is a Quentin Tarantino movie, and then he keeps doing that, which makes us keep feeling that way, you know?
Sure.
I think like a lot of the suspense is because you know that there's going to be some like big payoff. You don't know that your characters are safe because like lots of main characters die in Quentin Tarantino movies, sometimes even before they've really done anything. And it's just like, oh, you don't really know what to expect in terms of like the carnage that's going to come out of it.
Okay. And then I'm going to throw my hat into this ring.
Do it.
And say that in a dramedy.
Dramedy.
You have a will they, won't they? And then it's a will they, won't they do some smooching. But yeah. In a Quentin Tarantino, it's like a will they, won't they?
They kill each other.
Shooting.
They gonna die.
Oh, that's a funny comparison. Yeah.
So honestly, Quentin Tarantino is just trying to like give you all of those warm, fuzzy feelings of impending death. We kind of respect him for that. But
yeah.
I guess a more serious answer is that I don't think that Tarantino wants you to feel tension just for the tension, even though that is like a very cool sensory part of watching a Tarantino movie.
Right.
Agreed.
I think that he wants to rack up the tension because he does make use of a lot of gratuitous and graphic violence. And yeah. After a while, it's easy to become desensitized to that. So it's necessary to ratchet up that tension so that you become reinvested in what's about to happen
before
he like lets loose in his Tarantino way and like there's blood everywhere. So I think that it's an inevitable part of the kinds of things he likes to do, because he does like to do graphic violence, because I heard him say in an interview once that it's just like, oh, it's just so much fun. Like, that's how he said it. He likes putting that on the screen.
Yeah, see, it is. It's like sort of like a cathartic thing, I think.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, with all the attention, you kind of have to go big.
Right. It's like a feedback loop. He wants to build up to all of these signaturely Tarantino-esque, like, gratuitous violence things. And the only way that he can really do that and have it still be, like, engaging all the way through instead of, like, oh, now this is just random violence, is to have that level of tension.
Yeah.
So, that's what we got to say about that. Thank you very much for your question, Richard Baldus.
Thanks, Richie.
If you would like to have your question read on the air, engage on social media, ask us a question on Facebook, or leave a comment somewhere, and maybe we'll read it on this podcast and answer the question.
If you're lucky.
Oh, you know. You know how we love playing coy here on CGP.
There's clearly a lot of competition.
Tens of people are running for this. Tens.
There's dozens of us. Dozens.
You guys are a bunch of chatty fucking Cathys today.
Yeah, we are.
Goodness.
What are we not?
That's true.
It's like, it's part of our defining characteristics. Yeah.
It's true. Like, what else are we going to do on Besides this podcast? Charm. Are we going to play our musical instruments like people with talent? No.
Whoa.
We're just going to talk.
I feel so attacked.
Wow, Genevieve, fucking coming on, hosting your first episode, and you're already saying that we're all a bunch of talentless ass.
Fucking bold ass moves here.
It's a power play.
Power play, yeah, big one.
I mean, I could have just heckled you on social media, but I had to infiltrate your podcast first before. Oh, no. Friends, for your contributions to the broadcast. Now we can determine whose stories were of the most import, impact, or interest, and vote for the winner of this week's Gold Star Student Award.
Award.
Okay.
Award.
Yes. Okay, so I want to hear from Jeffrey as far as one out of five Nazi scalps.
Thank you so much. I was worried.
As to what you would rate Inglourious Basterds.
Oh, geez. You know, like, I was thinking, like, oh, yeah, that's probably a 4 out of 5, right? But then I was thinking about it. I was like, you know, I really can't think of much about this movie that I really don't like. Sometimes I get annoyed with having to do a lot of subtitles with the different languages.
That is true.
But, I mean, I think that it's probably better off for that in the long run, given the story that they have going. I think that it serves towards it. So, you know what?
A reluctant 5 Nazi scalps?
Maybe. Yeah, I think we're gonna do a reluctant 5 Nazi scalps.
We're gonna do a 4 Nazi scalps, but then the 5th one is bald or something?
Yeah, sure. We'll go for that. Yeah, I guess I might have to break my rule here and just go with a 4.5 out of 5 Nazi scalps, because it is a really good movie.
Tarantino broke Jeff. He had to go for the 0.5.
I don't like doing it because it's out of 5 instead of out of 10. But you know what? I'm coming around. I think we're going to have to go 4.5.
All right.
Out of 5, because it's a really good movie. A lot of it is like really satisfying, but it's not always, you know, one of the things I think about when I think about like, oh, my favorite stuff in media. So I don't know if I could really rightfully say that it is a 5 out of 5 for me, but.
Right. You're confidently claiming your subjective half scalp.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. I respect it. I respect it. What about you, Kanan?
I think I'm going to have to go with, just for the sake of evening it out, I'm going to have to go with 3 Nazi scalps.
3 Nazi scalps.
Because there were a lot of issues that I found with Inglourious Basterds, because it's not my favorite Tarantino. There are some aspects of the movie that I don't feel are very Tarantino. Like, that's a relatively linear plot. And one of my favorite things about Quentin Tarantino movies is when it's non-linear and you're kind of figuring things out and, like, trying to place when things are.
Sure. Yeah. Instead of a non-linear plot, you had, like, two parallel, like, concurrent plot lines.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty tame for a Tarantino.
More like Tame-antino.
I thought it was a very intelligent movie, though, especially with, like, the statements it's making about, like, the average German versus, like, a Nazi. And I think that was a very intelligent choice. But as a result, I ended up not actually liking a lot of, like, the Basterds besides, like, Brad Pitt. And honestly, I would have liked the Bear Jew more if Adam Sandler was originally cast as he was originally intended to be. Fun fact, they wanted to get Adam Sandler, but there was like scheduling That's issues funny. From what I hear, and Eli Roth stepped in. No offense to you, Mr. Roth.
Because he's listening.
however, I think if Adam Sandler had walked out of that tunnel, that would have been amazing, and I would have had to give it 5 stars. But anyway, so 3.
I don't think I can ever say that Adam Sandler would have improved something.
The fact that Adam Sandler would have been in a gory, violent action movie, yes.
So you're lukewarm 3 out of 5 Nazi scalps.
It's not lukewarm, it's just right.
Okay.
That's my 3.
Your not super enthused rating sounds like
I killed 3 men. Do you know how much that is in the West? That's like half a town's population in the West, 3 people. There's only like 6 guys in the caravan. I killed half of them. Damn, Jonathan, show me some respect.
This is a rating out of 5.
A murderer.
Okay, you're giving a 60%, and that passes on an engineering curve, but the rest of us don't see that as a great reading.
All right, you hippie.
So if you would please allow me to wrap this up, thank you very much for your rating.
You're welcome.
It seems that you were that you had high hopes for this movie's potential, but because you hold Tarantino to such a high standard, You felt a little shortchanged with this one.
A little bit, but I still think it was an excellent, excellent movie.
All right, so I guess it's now time for the Gold Star Student Award.
Oh, crap.
Yeah, it is.
Oh, man, what's a good golden award for this week?
A golden swastika. Give it to Jeff.
No.
I am not. I can't do it. Especially since I'm going to take this opportunity to educate about the swastika. Swastika, before it was stolen by the Nazis, the swastika is actually, the way it is supposed to be drawn, a symbol of good luck and peace.
Yeah.
Then it was stolen by the Nazis to mean definitely not that. yes, so I want everyone to know that it is time to reclaim the swastika, the real swastika, not the backwards bent one.
Can't give a... whatever.
And, yeah, it's not for the Nazis. Don't let them have it. That's neither here nor there. But anyway, I'm not going to award that award.
Okay. I thought that's how you were reclaiming it, but...
No, not like that.
Never like this.
Yeah. How about,
This is some Tarantino level suspense.
The golden nitrate film reel. Let's go with that. Who gets the golden nitrate film reel for today?
Boy, oh boy.
And this is a little bit of a difficult thing to do very fairly, since a lot of the time I could not hear Keenan.
But what I did have was so good.
But what you did have was solid and compelling, and I applaud your choice of film to represent. But Jeff also came out with a lot of like well-rounded ideas. I appreciate that you brought an animated series to this, because sometimes vengeance is cartoon-fantastic. That's not a word.
It's an anime, not a cartoon.
Truth. I will not distinguish between those two and draw the wrath of those who will oppose me.
Well, man, you're making a lot of enemies. First recording.
Animated features all together as one. Anime and cartoons have had like a long-running cultural cross-dialogue. I would rather treat them as distinct things that are closely related to one another, and you can probably not change my mind.
A discussion for another day, perhaps.
Yes, perhaps. I can't wait for all this sweet, sweet hate mail I'm gonna get. Anyway, I'm gonna have to give the gold nitrate film reel to Jeff Levitt today.
Sure. Good for you, Jeff. Just stay in your home. I'll be over in a sec to congratulate you. Don't go for the doors or anything.
Oh, shit. This is where the real revenge story begins.
You give me the golden reel.
And Keenan gets the golden gigabit reward because he needs more internet in his life. Right?
I wish.
That's what it is today.
All right, yeah. So I'm going to go now. Is that all right?
Okay.
No, I do got to go, so I'm sorry.
Okay, bye, dude.
Bye, kid.
Bye, guys. Yeah, before my internet cuts out again.
Okay. All right, that about wraps it up. Thank you for listening to the Common Geeking Program. I'm your host, Jonavi, and you can't find me. I'm not here. I have been joined by Keenan to the best of his ability.
He just left.
he just left.
I'll speak on Keenan's behalf of where you can find him.
Yeah, go ahead. Tell them where to find Keenan.
You can find Keenan in the wind. He is all around us, in your hearts, in your soul, inside your brownies. That's he'd say something like that.
Oh God.
And I have been Jeff Levitt. You can't find me most places. You can find me on Instagram. I have an Instagram, which is things I wish existed with a dot between each word. And yeah, that's my bit. And Keenan's bit, apparently.
All right, for a second, I was scared you were going to start giving a street address or something. Like, just for a split second, I was going to be like, oh, shit. No.
I would if I could. His house is purple. I'll let you figure it out from there.
Okay, anyway, next week, our episode will be hosted by Jeff, right?
Yeah, it is me.
Would you like to say a little about it?
Yeah, we're going to be watching a fun movie called Run, Lola, Run. It is... I believe German. It's a you know what? We'll tell you about what it's about next week, but we're going to be talking about stories with a non-linear narrative, so you know that much about it for sure. And yeah, we're going to have another new member of the podcast as well joining us.
Ooh, stay tuned. Out of curiosity, what is the run time for Run Lola Run?
It is good question. You know what? I think I have it open on a tab.
Okay.
1 hour and 15 minutes, looks like.
Okay. Cool. Be sure to tune in next Friday,
which is the 10th of April is when that airs. Not April. 10th, August. 10th of
August. I was going to say, I'm like, oh dear. How backlogged are we?
We're recording this almost a year in advance.
Oh, man. Be sure to tune in next Friday, on August 10th. 10th.
Yeah.
And follow Common Geeky Program on Facebook or Twitter at Geeking Program. Any engagement, such as sharing a post, tagging us, or tweeting hashtag CGP, will enter you into our raffle, the winner of which gets to choose the topic for a future episode. Reviewing us on Apple Podcasts is a critical help to growing the show, and we will read new reviews on the air. Anyway, thank you for listening, subscribing, sharing, and everything. We will talk to you, or at you, or both, next week.
Woohoo! Bye!
Bye!
And then right here, we should just put a random clip of something that Kenan said earlier in the episode right here, just so it feels like he's still here.
I killed 3 men.
Alright, that's it. Bye.
Cool.
This episode of the Common Geeking Program was hosted by John of the Iyer, joined by the representatives, Jeff Levitt and Kenan Kodish. This episode is sponsored by Rock Solid Wi-Fi Connection. The podcast is created and produced by Colin Ketchin and Jeff Levitt, with this episode edited by me, Jeff Levitt, as well as Colin Ketchin, and featuring original music by Colin Ketchin. Next week, we'll be talking about Run Lola Run and non-linear storytelling, so be sure to tune in for that on August 10th. And as always, thank you for listening to this.
All right. I'm at an hour 26, 37, 38, 39.
That 40. Sounds about right.
Yep.
Okay. All right, at 50.
Well, that's okay.
Cool.
You were fucking around. You're like, hey, let's do this in 3 fucking seconds.
Now.
Oh, you know me.
Now.
You know me and my figurative promiscuity.